We read in Joshua chapter 10 and from the first verse. Joshua 10 verse 1. Now Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and were living near them. He and his people were very much alarmed at this, because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. So Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. "Come up and help me attack Gibeon," he said, "because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites." Then the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it. The Gibeonites then sent word to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us." So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise, and the Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky, and more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "O sun, stand still over Gibeon. O moon, over the valley of Ashkelon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself on its enemies. As is written in the book of Jasher, the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. Now the five kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Makkedah. When Joshua was told that the five kings had been found hiding in the cave at Makkedah, he said, "Roll large rocks upon the mouth of it, in the mouth of the cave, and post some men there to guard it. But don't stop. Pursue your enemies. Attack them from the rear and don't let them reach their cities, for the Lord your God has given them into your hand. So Joshua and the Israelites destroyed them completely, almost to a man. But the few who were left reached their fortified cities. The whole army then returned safely to Joshua in the camp at Makkedah. And no one uttered a word against the Israelites. Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave and bring those five kings out to me." So they brought the five kings out of the cave, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. When they had brought these kings to Joshua, he summoned all the men of Israel and said to the army commanders who had come with him, "Come here and put your feet on the necks of these kings." So they came forward and placed their feet on their necks. Joshua said to them, "Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Be strong and courageous. This is what the Lord will do to all the enemies you are going to fight." Then Joshua struck and killed the kings and hung them on five trees, and they were left hanging on the trees until evening. At sunset, Joshua gave the order, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had been hiding. The mouth of the cave they placed large rocks, which are there to this day. That day, Joshua took Makkedah. He put the city and its king to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it. He left no survivors. He did to the king of Makkedah as he had done to the king of Jericho. Amen. And God will add his blessing to this public reading of his holy word. Now turn with me, if you will, to the passage we read together earlier in Joshua chapter 10. Among the many questions which exercise the troops on the battlefield are, how committed are the high command towards us? To what lengths will they go to ensure our victory? Now, any student of military history will tell you that these are very reasonable questions to ask. For again and again and again, men in the front line of battle have been treated as dispensable, as cannon fodder, as those who could readily be denied the necessary help. We read of some who have been told, "You're on your own. Don't expect any backup. It will not be forthcoming." I cannot think of anything which so undermines the morale of troops as the knowledge of the fact that they have been abandoned in the field of battle. It's very easy for the Christian to be persuaded in the midst of spiritual conflict that he has been abandoned by God, that he is a pawn in whom God has really very little interest. or that the work of their particular church is of little importance to him. Bergedi? Where's that? Temptations such as these are designed to make us feel isolated, vulnerable, and uncertain of any support from above. Well, this passage provides a glorious antidote to all such temptations. You will remember from last week that the Gibeonites, in the interests of self-preservation, had deceived Israel into making a peace treaty with them. Now, leaving aside the questionable motives for a moment, notice that as soon as they side with the people of God, they come under immediate attack. As soon as they stand foursquare with the people of God and are identified with them, they come under attack. Look first at the source of this attack. It came from the surrounding Canaanite tribes who felt betrayed by one of their number. Gibeon had let the side down. Verses 1 to 4 tells us that the king of Jerusalem called upon his neighbors to attack Gibeon to teach her a lesson for going over to the other side. This ganging up on new members of God's people has taken place throughout the course of history at a whole variety of levels. How many Christians know the experience of being treated as the ugly duckling by folks who were formerly their close friends? What's the answer? Simply this, that they had begun to stand foursquare with Jesus and his cause. Others know what it is to be pressurized and ridiculed. Children, students experience that. Folks at work get ribbed by their colleagues as a reaction to their becoming Christians. In some parts of the world, becoming a Christian means that your very life can be threatened. Why all this hostility? Because loyalty to God is something that the unbelieving world cannot understand. They feel threatened by it, and they will do all in their power to interfere with it. Now, this pressure on the new Christian does not come only from outside. These attacks are internalized as well. The new Christian can experience what it is to be bombarded by a conspiracy of sinful habits. The remnants of sinfulness within his heart take exception to the fact that he has left the kingdom of darkness for the kingdom of light. And they can bring such pressure to bear that the young convert begins to wonder if he is truly a Christian at all. This can produce a very real agony of soul, this kind of opposition. It was in this context that the young Augustine wrote, "I have become a puzzle to myself. He was commenting upon the remnants of his sinful nature doing battle within. And he couldn't understand all that was going on inside him. Well, if the first response we have to look at is the source of the attack and the cause of it, secondly, look at the response of Gibeon in verse 6 following. The Gibeonites sent word, you'll notice, to the people of God for help. Those whom they had committed themselves to, the people of Israel, are called upon to come to their aid. Now, that was a very obvious thing to do, was it not? Well, we don't always do the obvious. If only more young Christians could learn from this example, they could save themselves a great deal of unnecessary suffering. But you see, young Christians are often fearful to ask for help. They are frightened that they might be viewed as failures. They don't want to be thought of as Christians incapable of standing on their own two feet. Where do you think these kind of suggestions comes from? There are a number of young Christians here tonight. Let me encourage you to seek out help from older and more mature Christians when you come under pressure. Learn the value of unburdening yourself to them. Among other things, you will invariably discover that the particular difficulty you are experiencing is common to many Christians and not special to you. I can remember as a young Christian going through a great agony of heart myself, thinking I was the worst Christian in all the world. There was a particular temptation which with great regularity assaulted my mind and my heart. I can remember one day going to speak to my minister in Glasgow and telling him the great concerns of my heart. And he sat down with a smile and he said, "Oh, are you bothered with that temptation as well?" I floated home from church that day, all of a sudden, the recognition of the fact that other Christians come under these pressures. Not just me. But you see, had I failed to unburden myself to him, I could have gone through the rest of my life thinking I'm an absolute and complete failure, the worst Christian in all the world. I may now have other reasons for thinking that, but not that one. You see? Notice to Joshua's response to Gibeon's appeal. It is immediate. He doesn't say, "Well, I'm a bit busy just now. You see, we're in the midst of a campaign to take on the whole of the land of Canaan." Nor does he decide, Let's allow Gibeon to stew in their own juice for a while. After all, they were responsible for making life very difficult for us with all that deception and everything else. He could also have reasoned, God has promised that we will gain victory over these kings. Verse 8, God had made that clear. I can therefore take my time in coming to Gibeon's help. His response is immediate. He begins by taking his troops on a grueling forced march in the middle of the night through 20 miles of very, very rough terrain. those of us who are older in the faith need to ask if our response to cries for help is as committed and immediate and excuse-free as that of Joshua. There's a real word of challenge here for us, is there not? From beginning to end, the ensuing battle, recorded in verse 9 following, is God's battle. We need to underline that. This battle is God's battle. And God demonstrates this to be the case on at least three different levels. First, at the psychological level, we read that God confused the enemy. The sudden arrival of Joshua and the Israelite army was used by God to induce fear and panic among the Canaanite army. The morale of the enemy was undermined, and God knows how to do that. Our sovereign God can strike fear into the heart of all who are opposed to him. We see the intervention of God at a psychological level. Secondly, we see the activity of God in the natural realm. In verse 11, we read of the artillery of nature locking in on the enemy forces as a great storm of hailstones fell down upon them with devastating effect. Here is the God of providence using circumstances, using nature, using everyday events to come to the aid of his people. How we need to see, and as we said in our opening prayer, how readily we miss recognizing the hand of God's providence in the circumstances, the natural circumstances of life. But we see it here, God using nature. Thirdly, in verses 12 to 14, we read of God's activity on a supernatural level. In response to the prayer of Joshua, the sun and the moon stood still in the sky, thus lengthening the day to allow Joshua to complete his route. Now that's quite an astonishing statement, is it not? It's very difficult to find anything to equal it in the whole of the Old Testament. Hezekiah's experience of the shadow retarding is the nearest thing, but a whole day the sun stood still. Now, as a result of this somewhat supernatural intervention of God, we discover that this has given rise, on the one hand, to a great deal of skepticism, and on the other, to a great deal of rationalizing by embarrassed Christians who have tried to explain away this miracle. We need do neither. In order to understand this incident, it is helpful to begin by appreciating that God often uses as instruments of his judgment the so-called gods in which men have placed their confidence in preference to him. He uses as instruments of judgment those things which have displaced God from his rightful throne in the hearts of men. Now, had we time this evening, we could examine in some detail the plagues that fell upon the Egyptians. You know, one of the interesting things about the list of plagues that we have in Exodus is this, that in each case, the Egyptians worshipped the object of that plague. It was their God in which they placed supreme confidence and reliance. They worshipped the Nile, they worshipped the sun, they worshipped the frogs, and so on. God used the very things they worshipped to judge and plague them. He establishes his glory by showing his power over the things that men have made objects of their worship. Now, with that in mind, think of the two principal deities of the Canaanites. First of all, there was Baal, the storm god. Well, God brought about a storm of hailstones, and those hailstones rained down upon the five kings as their army fled. Can you imagine the response in their heart? We are being stoned by hailstones. Baal is in charge of the storm. He is the god of storms. Why is this storm being directed towards us and not against Israel? The God in which they had placed their confidence was a hollow God. They were to discover that the Lord God of Israel was the God of all nature. Then think too of Baal's consort, a female deity called Ashtoreth, Mother Earth, goddess of nature and fertility. Well, God suspended the laws of nature. The earth stopped spinning that the sun might for a longer period shine to the advantage of Joshua's army. Mother Earth was not only helpless to come to the aid of the Canaanites, she was used as an instrument of judgment against them. Do you see? The very thing that they worshipped, the nature god that they worshipped, was used by God as an instrument of judgment against them. God's intervention in battle sent then a twofold message. First of all, the Canaanites learned that the God of Israel was the true Lord of nature, and that their so-called gods came under his control. Secondly, there was a lesson for the people of God to learn. They discovered that there was no length to which God would not go in order to secure the victory of his people. Does it require the sun to stand still in the sky? Well, says God, I can arrange for that. There is no length to which God will not go for the good and the victory of his people. He would even overrule nature and stop the sun in the sky, if I can use pre-Copernican language. Many people find the reality of this cosmic miracle difficult to absorb. Well, let me ask this question. Did God not create the laws which hold the universe together? If he is unable to suspend those laws, as some would argue, that means that those laws are more powerful than the God who created them. And that's surely a nonsense. For he is the Lord of nature. Terrified disciples made this discovery, did they not? When Jesus stood up to silence the storm. Remember, he stood up in the boat and he says, "Be quiet." And the sea was still. And the wind dropped. There are no lengths to which God will not go. What did the disciples say? The astonished, awestruck disciples. Who's this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. This is an important truth which we need to bury in our hearts. There is no length to which God will not go to deliver his people from evil. You see, God has done much more than suspend the laws of nature. The incarnation of Jesus is a miracle of a far greater magnitude. It's the Son of Righteousness that our attention must be drawn to. It's not the plains of Ajalon, but the cross of Calvary's hill that God points to when he wants to say to his people, "Do you not realize and recognize that there are no lengths that I will not go to on your behalf for your deliverance?" The Lord of eternity was prepared to expire in order to triumph over a greater confederacy of evil than that which faced Joshua, to triumph over sin and death and hell and Satan. Is that not incredible in comparison with the sun standing still? Does that not begin to indicate something of the commitment of the high command towards his troops in the field of battle? Notice in closing, God did not act in a vacuum. His people were obliged to enter into the fruit of what he accomplished for them. The battle was God's battle, yes, but Israel still had something to do. The first thing I want you to notice is the exposure of evil here. You will see from verse 16 that the Canaanite kings hide in a cave, hoping to escape detection. They planned to stay hidden and to creep away under cover of darkness. Well, Joshua, having discovered their whereabouts, and after having the cave sealed, in verse 22, commands that they be brought out into the open, into the sunlight, in order to be dealt with. The enemy is exposed before the people. Now, I believe this provides us with a helpful picture of the way in which the Christian should treat evil which indwells, the evil of indwelling sin in his own heart. The Christian requires to be diligent in searching within his life for all that would take up force of arms against his newfound allegiance to God and expel that from his heart. It needs to be brought out into the sunlight of God's grace, in order to have all its ugliness exposed and dealt with. How is it dealt with? Well, again, the passage provides us with a number of pictorial answers. But I want you to notice that secondly,
Israel are required to recognize that their enemy is a vanquished foe. The army commanders are told to place their feet on the necks of the kings. Now, what's the significance of that symbolism? There was a need for Israel not to be intimidated by the powers of evil which God had vanquished. And so Joshua says, these powerful kings, which have perhaps struck some terror into the hearts of the people of God, put them on the ground and let the commanders put their feet in their necks. Let Israel see that these are defeated enemies in God's battle. We need to see the enemy in this light in order to vanquish the paralysis and the panic which can so easily grip our hearts. So too the Christian needs to see that Christ has all evil power under his feet. Isn't this the picture that we have in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 15 and 25 and Ephesians 1 and 22, which speaks of Christ reigning and waiting for his enemies who are under his feet to be thoroughly routed? Now, failure to recognize this, the triumph of Christ over his enemies, contributes to a great many defeats in the lives of God's people. The early church certainly recognized the importance of this profound truth, and they communicated it very powerfully in some of their early church buildings. Many of the early Christians were illiterate, and as a result, to communicate basic and fundamental truths in parts of the church, mosaics were used, and they were placed all the way around the church so that as the people came in, they could say, yes, that's that truth, and that's that truth, and that's that truth. I can remember years ago visiting the town of Ravenna in Italy, and there's a very ancient Christian Basilica, San Apollinare. And as you enter that basilica, you see that the central mosaic depicts the person of Christ with his foot firmly placed upon a serpent, cross in his hand, foot in the serpent. And the message is clear. The early church came in, and the first thing that hit them in the face was this: Jesus has triumphed over evil on behalf of his people. Christians need not to be intimidated by the power of evil. Although Satan is still on the loose, he is a defeated foe. And although the remnants of our sinful nature cling to the new natures God has given us, it no longer has the dominion over our lives it once had. Our enemies, our spiritual enemies, have been vanquished upon the cross. What we need to see this evening is where Christ foot is. The enemy defeated, a vanquished foe. Thirdly, we need to learn from the radical manner in which Joshua dealt with these human enemies. The five Canaanite kings were put to death. They were shown no mercy. Their continued existence, you see, would have threatened not only the physical but the spiritual integrity and existence of the nation. And again, the picture describes the manner in which we must deal with the evil we find in our own heart. Whenever we are tempted to be lenient with sin, to make friends with it, we need to remind ourselves of Joshua's activity here. We need to recognize that if we are lenient, sin undealt with will wreak havoc in our lives. We need to remind ourselves that God has dealt mercilessly with sin on the cross because it is opposed to all that God is. God is a creator. Sin brings destruction. God quickens and makes alive. Sin deadens. God draws men into a caring relationship. Sin estranges men in their relationships. God's love reaches out beyond himself. Sin is self-gratifying and self-absorbing. Now, if God dealt with sin severely, so must we deal severely with the sin which we dig out. And we need to dig it out of the caves of our hearts. The word the New Testament uses for this process is mortification. It means to put to death, to render powerless. And that means being prepared to slay the bad temper and the critical spirit, the lust and the jealousy, the pride and the harsh tongue, all that is opposed to God's rule within the caverns of our hearts. We may excuse ourselves and say, it's our temperament. We just have to live with these things. No, we don't. Jesus' death on the cross has won for us a victory over sin's power. It no longer has the stranglehold it once had upon us. Christ's nature indwells the heart of his people. We have access to a new source of life. If we are Christians, we are a new people. Oh, we aren't sinless, because the remnants of our sinful nature still cling to the folds of the new man that God has made us. But we're no longer obliged to obey the old sinful nature when it cracks its whip in our lives. When you detect its activity in the caves of your heart, then call upon the promised aid of God's Holy Spirit to help you to mortify it, to put it to death, to deal radically with it, lest it begins to undermine the spiritual integrity and fabric of your witness. As we refuse to yield to the clamoring, authoritative demands of sin, and refuse to feed those sinful appetites in our hearts, do you know what happens? They lose increasingly their power to influence or lie. This is demanding work. It is not something we do once and for all. The Bible does not teach instant holiness. No crisis experience can replace the necessity of this daily dealing with sin, this daily mortification. And we do all this in the knowledge that never in this life will we reach perfection. We wait heaven for that. But in this life we are called upon to press on and on and on and possess more and more land for God as we deal with all that's wrong in our lives, with all that opposes His rule, with all that takes on the role of the opposition in the field of battle. And as we deal with that, we are assured of God's presence and power to help. Has the high command abandoned us in the field of battle? Are we left to battle with the evil of indwelling sin on our own, with no support, no resources? Never. But we need to see and to learn the value of what God has accomplished for us through the cross. We need to recognize that ours is a defeated enemy. We need to determine in our hearts that we will enter into the fruit of that victory and deal radically with all that is opposed to God's rule. For to do other would be an act of gross ingratitude and grave neglect. May God seal His word to our hearts.